Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility, that's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, and here we are once again with Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. And the unexpected, as always, is the fun part of the podcast. We love to carry on different kinds of conversations with people, learn about them. And you know what? I'm going to say once again, for any of you listening out there, I'd love to have conversations with you. I'll bet you have stories that we should talk about. So definitely reach out. At michaelhinkson.com/podcast or michaelhi@accessibility.com, and love to chat with you. But for now, we have Kelly Bradenhoff, who is here with us. She is an author, an ASL interpreter, and a Kickstarter campaign runner par excellence. But does that elevate you or what, Kelly?
Yikes.
Welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you for having me today. I'm really excited to be talking to you.
Well, I'm really excited to have a chance to chat with you and learn all about you and learn why you're unstoppable. We started this podcast because we think that everyone has a story to tell. We all have had challenges in our lives and we've overcome them. And it doesn't need to be a huge challenge, but still a challenge is a challenge. And when we overcome it, that's great. And when we recognize that we did something that we didn't think we can do, then I think we fall into this concept of being able to move toward a mindset of unstoppability. And so we started Unstoppable Mindset, and we have a lot of fun with it. Well, why don't we start with your story a little bit? Why don't you tell us about you kind of growing up or anything about that that you think we ought to know?
Well, sure. I'm a fan of your mindset, your podcast. I think this is just the coolest thing. So like I said, just super excited to be here today. I've been an ASL interpreter for more than 30 years and an author for just over 3 years. So although I'm a veteran interpreter, I'm still a baby author and publisher. I learn new things every day. So I guess you can teach an old dog new tricks. I guess I've moved around. One thing that's interesting about me is I've moved around quite a bit. I grew up in Connecticut. I've lived in Nebraska, Boston, Hawaii, Seattle. And then now we've been in Nebraska for quite a while since
Boston,
then.
Boston,
yes.
So can you say it? Pack your car and have it yard?
Of course, of course. My uncle is from South Boston. And so he married my aunt, who's from upstate New York. And listening to the two of them talk was so fun. I lived with them for a summer in college. And I just had such a fun time, especially if they had a little discussion or something, you know, and they get the voices raised and they'd start going in their accent.
They revert.
Yes.
I lived in Winthrop, Massachusetts for 3 years and spent some time in the Boston area before then. I've been back a little bit, but I love the accent, but I love Massachusetts. I love New England in general. And my wife and I have a story about Mystic, Connecticut. We were going there for something and I don't even remember what it was. And we were traveling the right way, but we were traveling a lot further than we thought we needed to get to Mystic. So ever since, I've been saying that one of the things about Mystic is it moves around and doesn't stay in one place. So I'm sticking
to my only memory of Mystic is going there on probably a sixth grade field trip. And, you know, afterwards at the field trip, they take you through the gift shop, and I bought a little, pewter whale.
Ooh.
Well, yeah, I'm sure I still have it somewhere on the bookcase somewhere in my house.
We stopped at a restaurant there the second time we went to Mystic, and I'm still convinced it wasn't in the same place it was the first time. But we went to a restaurant and sat right along the river and watched the drawbridge coming up, which was really fun. Yeah,
that is really fun. Yeah, definitely.
We love New England, and I hope that we get a chance to go back there. I have all sorts of stories about Boston. I went a lot over to Thanel Hall and to Quincy Market and ate at Durgan Park. Have you ever eaten there?
I have eaten there, yes. I love Thanel Hall.
I don't know whether Durgan Park is still open. I've heard that it isn't, and I've heard that it is, but I'll have to tell you. Well, I'll tell you the story about Durgan Park. It's at Durgan Park, for those who don't know, is a restaurant that, if it's still there, serves food family style. And they have tables along the side that will seat four people, but you have to have four people if you want to sit at one of those tables. If you have three, you sit at the long tables in the middle. If you have two, long tables in the middle. Mm-hmm. And they're very snotty about it. And in fact, the waitresses and waiters are hired to be snots. It's all an act, but they're supposed to be absolutely obnoxious. They're what some people would say the typical close New England style of being, if you will. But anyway, we go into the restaurant one night, and it was me and two other people and my guide dog, Holland, who is a golden retriever with the most luscious eyes in the world. And the hostess said, you know, I'm just going to let you guys sit at one of the tables for four. So she seats us, and the waitress comes over and she says, what are you people doing here? You can't sit at this table. And I said, well, the hostess put us here. No, she didn't. You just snuck in here. You can't sit at this table. And she yelled at us. And we said, no, we got to be seated here because we have a guide dog under the table. No, you don't. I don't believe that. You're not going to fool me with that. You can't sit here. And she just went on. And she goes away and she comes back and she said, you can't sit here. I said, look under the table. Finally, she looks. There's these eyes just staring back at her. And she just melts. And the next thing we know, she goes away. One of the things about Durgan Park is that when they serve prime rib, it's a huge piece of prime rib that takes the whole plate. She comes back with this plate. She said, somebody didn't eat much of their prime rib. Can I give it to the dog?
Aww.
And it was great. But it's just fond memories of all over Boston. So I'm glad you had a chance to be there.
Definitely.
Well, enough about me and that. So you've lived all over.
We have. We have moved a lot. We haven't moved a lot recently, but when I was younger, I moved quite a bit. Yes.
What caused you to be moving around?
We grew up in Connecticut. And then in high school, my parents decided, my mom's from Nebraska. So, and my dad's from upstate New York. So when I was in high school, our family moved to Nebraska. And then when my husband and I first got married, he worked for a construction company who moved us to Hawaii for 5 years.
That worked.
That was a great honeymoon. We'd only been married 6 weeks. And so that was a 5-year honeymoon. That was awesome. Our first couple of kids were born there, and we decided that after a year or so, they really didn't get to see their grandparents very often. So we decided to move back to the mainland, and we made a stop first in Seattle, and then we came back to Nebraska. So we've been here for quite a while, but I really enjoyed getting to experience all the different cultures and all the different places. And I also have a very soft spot in my heart for New England too.
Well, it's great to live in various parts of the U.S. It shows what a wonderful and just incredible country we are, with all sorts of different cultures that can really blend and meld together to form what we get to experience if we only keep the culture going as really we are the melting pot, And that just makes it so great when we get to see that.
I totally agree. Yeah.
So how old are your kids now?
They are grown up. We have 4 kids, 3 boys and 1 girl. And so the oldest is going to be 29. And our youngest just graduated from college last year. So he's 22.
In Nebraska?
In Nebraska, we're all Huskers. Everybody's a Husker.
Go Huskers.
Go Big Red. Yep. So, but we have 4 grandkids too. So that's a lot of fun. And we're really lucky they all live in town. So we get to see them quite a bit.
That works. So you see, you fixed it up. So you now have this Bradenhoff ghetto, if you will.
Yes. My Twitter handle is actually in Brockenville because one of my friends quite a while ago used to tease me that I was trying to create my own village. So we call it in Brockenville.
There you go. It works. Nothing wrong with that. Well, so I know you're an author and I know that you are an ASL interpreter and so on. Tell me how you got into being involved with ASL and a little bit more about all that.
Sure. In high school, I volunteered at a camp for deaf kids. My parents wanted me to do something in the summer and stay out of trouble. So they kind of sent me to go volunteer at this camp. And I didn't know any sign language. So I got a book and I started trying to figure out a few signs before I first went to this camp. Of course, the first few weeks I was there, I had no idea what anyone was saying because they were all using sign language and I didn't know it. But by the end of the summer, I had learned quite a bit and I had made some really good friends. And I just kept learning during the school year when they were all gone. I kept taking classes and reading more books. And it actually turned out to be the language that I took when I was in college. It counted as my foreign language. And I just kept learning and hanging around with deaf people. And eventually my mentors in ASL, the deaf people that I was friends with, invited me to try interpreting for them. And if I had known, I wasn't very good, but they were very kind and they asked me to interpret. So I did. And it just ended up kind of something I fell into. It wasn't something I intended to do, but it's become my whole life's work and I really like it.
So is that kind of a full-time job or your vocation then?
Yeah, I would say it's hard to say what's my vocation because I also really love being an author, even though I haven't been published until recently, but I've been a writer my whole life. In college, I actually majored in English and I always wanted to be a writer. I guess the interpreting thing just kind of was a very long detour, but I always wrote even when I was interpreting and raising my family and stuff. So once my kids started getting into high school and college and I started looking around for something to fill some of my empty hours, that was when I really got serious about finishing my first book.
Well, from an ASL standpoint and interpreting, it certainly is something that's a little bit different. What have you learned about deafness and disabilities and so on from being involved in all of that?
Oh my goodness. We don't have enough. There's not enough time in the day to talk about it. It's just changed my whole mindset. Like you've talked about that. I think it's just a way of looking at the world. Like a lot of people think that people who are deaf and hard of hearing, it's about your ears being broken, but it's really just a different way to move through life. So instead of a hearing world, like they have a visual world. So everything is visual. So it's like the opposite of what you experience now. So it's just a way of moving through the world, you know, that, and so instead of being like broken and something that needs to be fixed, it's just kind of a way of life. I guess I just have a lot of respect. I work a lot in at the University of Nebraska. So I work with a lot of college students and I've over the years done just, gosh, 20 something different majors. I sit in on all the classes. I interpret what the teacher's saying at the front of the class and the discussions that the students do. And so I've gotten to learn a lot of things just by osmosis over the years. And I have a really deep respect for the students because you know, their classmates sitting in the same room with them, they can listen to the lecture, write notes, you know, go online and do stuff all while this is all going on. Whereas the deaf student has to sit there and watch me. If they want to take their own notes, they kind of have to look down and take their own notes, but then still keep an eye on me. And then if there's a PowerPoint, they're trying to watch that. And if there's a video, they're hoping that it has good captions. And so like, there's so many things going on that it's amazing that they can get as much as they do out of the classes. And then of course they have to study so much more afterwards, because a lot of times they have to go back over the notes or back over the reading to see what they missed, because they were just, you know, a lot of their attention during the class is on me. So it's just given me a really healthy respect for how intelligent and how what hard workers the students are. And I've just kind of seen that in all walks of life. I've interpreted for a lot of different situations and different businesses and all kinds of things. And I just, I'm always in awe of how hard workers the deaf students and just deaf adults in their job are.
How do the students then really get the job of note taking done? Do they oftentimes have people who take notes for them, or are they successful enough at taking notes themselves?
It really depends on the student and their preference. You know how some people don't mind having someone else take the notes because then they can pay more attention to the interpreter and the PowerPoint and the teacher. But then other people maybe don't, you know, when you take notes, we could listen to the same speaker and your notes would be different than mine.
Right.
And so
exactly.
Some students don't really trust that another student is going to write down the same things that they would have written down if they were taking their own notes. So it really is a personal preference. But luckily now with the technology, I have a couple of students who, so they're deaf and they use ASL and they use interpreters, but they also use CART, which is the captioning service. And so they'll have a laptop, or they also use like an Otter, which is an app mm-hmm. that the teacher wears a microphone, and then it makes a transcript of everything that the teacher has said, and then they can save it. So I have a few students who, even though they're, you know, pretty much dependent on the sign language for comprehension, they still use the transcript, because then they can go back later and like highlight the parts that they thought were important. And then it's kind of, I think, more in their control. Or if sometimes like an English word has, you know, five different signs for it. And so if I do a sign and they want to know what the exact English word was, they can look at the transcript and see, oh, okay, that's the word that, you know, I need to remember, or that's the word that I want to know. So I think it's great that they have all these tools, because gosh, back in the day when I first started, none of that existed. And a lot of times they would just have someone else take notes for them. And if that person wasn't a good note taker, they were kind of out of luck.
We use Otter actually to do the transcribing of all of these podcasts, so that when Unstoppable Mindset is published, there is a written transcription as well. So we use Otter to do that. And oftentimes I will use Otter to transcribe a meeting or make it possible for people to come into the podcast and listen and watch, if you will, in real time, which makes a lot of sense. So I found that Otter works really well.
Yeah, I've tried several different apps and different services, because I have a thing too, like you. I really want to make my website as accessible as possible and my appearances as accessible as possible. So I get transcripts made of all the podcasts that I do, whether the provider does or not. And so I've tried several different services, and I do agree that I think Otter is it produces a good product, and the price is good too. So
price is certainly right. You're right. The price is certainly right. But also, it does a good job and it's improving over time. Some people have said there are better systems than Otter, and I haven't really tried other services. And the people who help with the podcasts have looked at various things, and we all end up settling on Otter. It really works well.
That's good to know. That's good to know. Because a couple of years ago, I tested several and I haven't rechecked back into it in the last 6 months. It's great. I think the one of the good benefits of the pandemic has been how everyday people have realized that speech to text and other just things that we used to think of as being accessible for people with disabilities are now helpful for like everyone. And people have just come to realize that with all the Zoom meetings and all of the work from home solutions. So things that used to be just in the realm of special are now every day, and they're all getting better because we all demand that they get better. So the AI captions and everything are so much better than they were even just a few years ago.
Well, and look at that. You bring a very good point to light, which is that oftentimes there are things that we use that when other people start to use them, first of all, makes them much, much more affordable, but also that will cause them to improve a lot more than otherwise they would have. Look at Dragon Naturally Speaking that started out as Dragon Dictate and did okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But now Dragon is a lot better. I don't think that it transcribes as well as Otter does in terms of plugging in punctuations and so on. But I'm not surprised or wouldn't be surprised if that improves over time. But when you look at what Otter does, it's pretty incredible.
It is. It really is. And what's incredible to me is the short amount of time that it's gotten better. So yeah. I think that's great. But like you said, I guess it's sad to me that it took a pandemic for enough people to use the tools that we've all been using for years to, you know, demand a higher quality and a lower price. But I guess, you know, if that's one good thing that comes out of all this, then that's great.
I think we tend to just get locked in to doing things one way, and we, for whatever reason, tend to be very slow at looking at other options. And you're right, the pandemic has made a significant difference. And look at how many people are using Zoom as opposed to pre-pandemic, yet Zoom has been there. The other thing that we've noticed along the way with Zoom is that they have deliberately and absolutely focused on accessibility and inclusion. So when a person who is blind encounters a problem with Zoom and something isn't working right, there's a process to report that. And we find that very quickly it gets resolved because they have a whole team working on issues to make sure that Zoom continues to be very inclusive.
Yes, I agree. Because I think when we first started with Zoom, the only way you could have captions was hiring a person to physically do the captions. And then once they started making them automatic and everything, that was huge. That was huge. I'm glad to hear that they have a team doing it. And I agree, their improvements have been amazing.
I don't want to put Zoom on the spot, but have you compared Otter with the Zoom automatic closed captioning?
I guess if I just stop and think about it, I think they're pretty similar. What's actually kind of funny is when I will do a large meeting on Zoom where I'm one of the interpreters, so I'm one of the little heads in the Brady Bunch group of right. people on Zoom. So I'll interpret for some of the deaf people in the meeting. And what I'll do sometimes is I'll turn on the captions because, you know, occasionally I might have a hard time hearing someone talking right. or I might miss something or whatever. And so I can look at the captions and see if, you know, try to correct myself or, you know, check my accuracy. And so I have seen some pretty bad interpretations on or transcript on Zoom and on Otter where things just don't come out right. It's definitely for people who speak like standard slow American English. Once you have any kind of an accent or any kind of, if you speak too quickly, then the captions pretty much everywhere are a lot harder to understand. But they, like I said, I still think they've gotten a lot better, which
they,
is
oh, awesome. They have. I only asked that just out of curiosity because I know that the service is there to do automatic transcription or captioning. Mm-hmm. And I've never asked anyone exactly how well it does, except I've heard that it does a good job, but I've never compared it to like Otter or something. And I bought Otter for Teams. And the reason I did that is so that it is now set up and integrated with Zoom. So it automatically starts when I open a Zoom meeting. And what I do usually is unless there's a need to, I will stop it, but it automatically starts when I come into a meeting that I initiate. And that's great because then I don't even have to think about it. And it's an effort of volition if I want to stop it.
Oh yeah, that's great. I didn't realize you could set it up that way. That's awesome.
Yeah, the Otter for Teams, I think unless the price has changed, it was like $240 a year. And if you're a nonprofit or whatever, it's half that. So it's not even a lot of money to do it, which is what's great.
That is, that's awesome. Well, so, like you said, the more users that use things, then the cheaper the price for everyone. And I think that's what we're seeing now with a lot of these tools.
It is ironic that we have to go through something like a pandemic to see things become more available and for people to start to see that maybe some of the tools that, say, a person who is blind or low vision or a person who is deaf or hard of hearing uses might very well be relevant for the rest of us. I'm still amazed that in driving with people using cell phones, we don't find more automatic use of the verbal technology, VoiceOver for Apple and TalkBack on an Android. I'm surprised that we don't see more use of those verbal systems in the driving experience. There's no reason not to do that and do more to keep people's eyes on the road. Unfortunately, we're going the other way. We're getting more driving experiences with touch screens, which means somebody's got to watch the screen or look down and then quickly look back at the road. Why should that even have to happen today? Because we have such good voice technology and we can also have good voice input technology to go along with it.
That's an excellent point. That's so true. Yes, there's definitely, you know, all the fancy touch screens, but when I got my latest car, I had to sit in the driveway with the owner's manual for an hour just to figure out how to reprogram the clock. So yeah, you definitely don't want to be doing any of that while you're on the road.
Well, if you, and I love Teslas, and I think that the technology is great. It is demonstrating the state-of-the-art technology that's out there, but it's all controlled by a touchscreen, which yeah, mean as a blind passenger, I can't even do what a passenger would do to tune the radio or turn on a podcast or turn on whatever other services are available, much less anything else, because it's all touchscreen. And there's no reason for that today. We should be able to keep people's eyes more on the road, even if you have the Tesla Co-Pilot function, which can take over a good part of the driving experience. It's not an autonomous vehicle software, but it can help with the driving experience. People should be keeping their eyes on the road, not watching a touchscreen. And I'm still amazed that we're not seeing more people recognize the value of audio input and output.
I did not realize that. I rode in my first Tesla just a few months ago, and it was really neat, but I just assumed that they had voice input things. I mean, wow, that's really shocking. As fancy as that whole system is, that is very surprising.
Well, let me rephrase it slightly.
Email to Elon and say, hey.
Well, let me rephrase it a little bit. There is availability of voice input for some things, but it's not an automatic process. So you have to invoke it, then you have to do something, I think, to make it work every time you want to use it. What I'm saying is it should be as much a part of the driving experience as anything else. And I'm saying it should be more a part of the driving experience than using a touchscreen. It should be automatic. And we don't do that. Mm-hmm. We're too used to eyesight, and we think that eyesight is the only game in town. Just like I'm sure that people who are deaf or hard of hearing would say that most people think that hearing is the only game in town. And in reality is neither is true.
Exactly.
I've said for years that people with disability, people who have eyesight have their own disability, and that is they're light dependent. They can't do things without light. Thomas Edison, as the Americans with Disabilities Act would define it, developed a reasonable accommodation for light dependent people when he created the light bulb. Let's get real. And I don't mean that facetiously. Yes. It's true. You know,
it is.
It's unfortunate that people are so locked into doing things one way that they're missing opportunities to make driving safer. But there you go.
I love that. I love that idea. I love that idea. I think that should be, you should make that a thing. That should be a political movement. I love that.
Yeah, well, we got to get Elon to go along with it.
Well, you know, he's kind of busy with Twitter right now. So maybe he once is. He gets that all wrapped up, then he could focus his brain power on this.
Well, once he gets it set up, and if he's going to do Twitter, then we'll start doing tweets.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Ah, what a world we live in, right? It's kind of fun. So you said that you've done a lot of writing. You've been very much involved in writing since college and so on. Why do you like writing so much?
Honestly, I don't know. I think it's just how I think, how I process things. It's communication, talking to people like you. That's just kind of how I think. It's just what I do. It's just who I am. That's a pretty simple answer.
Well, hey, it works. It works. So you said you just pretty recently got involved in starting to actually write books.
Yeah. I think it was 2014. I joined NaNoWriMo for the first time, which for people who haven't heard of that, it stands for National Novel Writing Month. And it's in November where, gosh, by this day, by last year, I think it was around 750,000 people around the world try to write 1,667 words a day for 30 days, and you come up with a 50,000 word manuscript by the end of the month. And that was signing up for that challenge was because I'm kind of competitive. So if I sign up for a challenge like that, I'm going to do it. So that was like the thing that broke the barrier for me of just having ideas and just wanting to write and whatever, and actually finishing a manuscript for the first time. That's what kind of gave me that push to actually do it.
So what, did you publish your own books, or are they published through a publisher, or what?
Yes, they are. They're self-published. I tried for about a year to publish my first, or to find an agent and all of that for my first one. And then at the same time, I was also checking into self-publishing. And I don't know, I think just a lot of factors kind of all converged. And I just decided at the end that self-publishing was the way to go. I'm kind of a control freak, and I like to have my input into how to make, you know, I hire my whole team. So I have an editor and a cover designer and proofreaders and all of that stuff. And I get to decide what the finished product ends up to be. And it turns out that, I'm kind of bossy, I guess.
You have a publicist who helps with the PR and all that?
I do. It's called Creative Edge is the one that I use, and I've really enjoyed being part of that group.
I met Mickey a couple of months ago, actually, for the first time. He was introduced to me by someone else that we interviewed on the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. And she said, you know, he works with a lot of authors who might very well have interesting stories for you. And so that's how we met him, and we've actually started working with him as well. We're just getting started. But having written Thunder Dog, which was, and we're blessed by the fact that it was a number one New York Times bestseller, and it was published by Thomas Nelson, part of HarperCollins now, but then we self-published our second book, which was called Running with Roselle, which was kind of more for youth, but more adults buy it than kids do. And it's the story of me growing up and Roselle growing up, and then how we met after she became a guide dog in training and she became my guide dog, and, you know, kind of went from there. But I love writing, but I haven't done that much of it. We are starting to work on a third book, and that'll be a lot of fun. And we just got a book contract for that as well. So that's pretty exciting.
That's great. Congratulations. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
But I'm curious, you've written, I guess, basically what, two different kinds of books, children's books and mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do mysteries? How do you come up with a plot, and how do you make it all come together? Because I think mystery writing has to be, if you do it well, it has to be a real challenge to come up with a, not only a plot, but create all of the scenes, do all the things that you need to do, and essentially keep the solution hidden till the end of the book, unless there's some value in presenting that earlier and it's really how you get there.
Yeah, that's a funny question, because I definitely write in extremes. I mean, I write 70,000 word mysteries, and then I write 500 word picture books for the children's books. So very different approaches. But yeah, the mysteries and thrillers are kind of the things that I have always read my whole life. So I thought when I wanted to do that first NaNoWriMo challenge, I decided to kind of mash up all of my experiences. Like I said, I've lived in Hawaii, Nebraska, the East Coast, Seattle. So I kind of took all of those different elements working at a college, and I put them all together into this murder mystery. And I got about two thirds of the way through and realized exactly what you said, that writing a mystery is hard. It's actually one of, I think, the most difficult genres to do, because exactly for the reason you said, you want to make that mystery puzzle complicated enough that it can't be solved too early. Mystery readers are very smart people, and so it's very challenging coming up with enough suspects and clues to keep people guessing until the end. I guess I just love a challenge. I think it's fun, but it's also just what I love to read and write. So it was kind of the most natural thing to write.
I think you just hit on it, essentially. Mysteries are puzzles, and puzzles are as good as it gets. Who are your favorite mystery writers?
Oh, I have so many.
yeah, me too.
Yeah. I think the ones I kind of grew up with was like Sue Grafton. So the letter A is for alphabet. Mm-hmm. Those Janet Ivanovich, there's Stephanie Plum series.
Stephanie Plum. Hey, love, come on. Stephanie, we all love Plum. Diesel, but that's another story.
Oh yeah. Diesel's awesome too. Well, I'm sure you said you lived in New Jersey, right?
Oh yes.
Yeah. So you're, I'm sure, very familiar with
Princeton.
Trenton and Stephanie,
and Trenton.
Stephanie, yeah. Plum. And then I also just love like John Grisham and James Patterson and Michael Connelly. I mean, gosh, I haven't really met very many mysteries that I didn't like.
Yeah. My favorite still is Rex Stout with the Nero Wolfe series.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I've never solved any of his books before the end, and I worked at it. I love Mary Higgins Clark, but I was able to basically figure out all of the mean people in that before the end of the book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Still, they were fun to read.
It's fun, right? I mean, as long as it's a good story, even if I've guessed or have an idea of who did it by the end, as long as the characters still keep you in it, and a lot of times the setting is kind of a character too, then I don't mind, reading to the end to confirm that I was right. I think what's funny, since I became a writer, and I don't know, you can tell me if this is true for yourself, but since I became a writer, an author, I'm kind of ruined for reading. Like, I read a lot, but I read now to learn and to see what, when I read a really good book, I love to pick it apart and see why it's good, and not just the structure of it, but like if that paragraph was beautiful, I'll go back and read that paragraph several times and try to figure out what is so great about that paragraph. Or when someone throws a twist or a turn in, or I thought I had knew who it was, and then at the end I find out it was someone else, I just love that that thrill of like, oh, you fooled me, and I really like to think about all of that. But that means that a lot of times I'm not really enjoying the book. I'm like studying the book. And so I have found that if I really get so sucked into a book that I am not doing that, that means that it's a really, really good book, because if it took me out of my analysis into just enjoying it, then that's a I mean, that's the mark of a very good book.
Sue Graff passed away from cancer. Did her last book ever get published? Because I don't think she finished it, did she?
It did not.
I didn't think it did.
It's definitely one of the
Z is for zero, yeah.
Yeah, the sad things, it's not finished. I don't even know how far she got in it, but it wasn't finished enough to be published, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of what happened. But her mysteries were definitely some of the best. And we read them all. And some twice, which is always fun. If I want to read a book a second time, and I don't have that many hours in the day that's easy to do, but if I want to read a book a second time, then I know that there is something about it that I must have enjoyed. And we read here a lot of books on audio, Audible and mm-hmm. other sources. The reason we do is that instead of watching TV, we pipe books through the house. My wife has learned to listen to audio. So we listen to books together. What I've been occasionally finding are editor mistakes where they said something and then later on referring back to something, they say something different. Somebody messed up in editing it. And I don't see it often, but I do occasionally see it and I always find them, which is kind of fun.
It's funny because, you know, even though my books are self-published, I work really hard not to have those kinds of errors.
Yeah.
They go through an editor, at least one editor, numerous beta readers, numerous proofreaders. And then, you know, 6 months after I publish it, I'll open it up and I see a typo. And it's like, at first I used to get so frustrated at that. And then now I saw something one time on Facebook. It was like, cheers to you, you typo. You made it through 3 rounds of editing, 10 proofreaders, and you still made it through. You go, you know.
When I was in college, we used in freshman and sophomore physics a series of books called the Berkeley Physics Series because it came out of there. And I had a dorm mate who looked in detail at every single book looking for a mistake, because he said a lot of books there are editing mistakes. And he said he finally found one in one of the Berkeley physics books, but he said it was so fun looking just to see any error, and he couldn't find them in the Berkeley physics series. It was just incredible that he spent that time. On the other hand, he was an excellent student, so I guess he learned from it as he was reading.
I have a niece who's a doctor, and they actually, some textbook company paid her. I don't know if she just got free books or if she actually got paid. Her last year of med school, they paid her to go through as she was going through the textbook, to note down any errors that she found.
See, it's always good to read as much as possible and proofread as much as possible. And you're right. There's nothing like a good editor to help.
Right. Exactly.
So how hard was it to write your first mystery?
Oh,
must have been a lot of courage.
I think I must have gone through 10 or 15 drafts. It took me 5 years to finish. It was ugly. There was a lot of tears, but you know, you just learned so much. I kind of consider it like getting a master's degree. Did it at home with my own process. But, you know, I just had to learn a lot. You have to be humble. You have to be willing to accept criticism and advice from other people. But I feel like it taught me a lot. And of course, then the second book teaches you even more, and the third, and, you know, each one you do, I think you just learn more either about yourself or about writing. I love to read books about writing craft and how to do better. You know, I want every single book that I write to be better than the last. I think most authors are that way.
Do they get easier the more you write?
That's a funny question, because I'm right in the middle of writing my fourth mystery right now, and I've been stalled for quite a while. And what it's taught me is just about myself and my process and what I thought my process was versus what I'm finding. I thought I could speed it up, but it's actually making me slow down. So that means that I was not speeding it up correctly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know whether it becomes easier or not. I have been very blessed. When we did Thunderdog, I had someone to collaborate and help with it, Susie Flory. And that happened because she actually found me, because she was writing a book called Dog Tales, which was 17 stories about dogs who had stories. And she wanted to include Roselle in that, and she did. But as we discussed my story, she said, you should really write a book. And so we got started down that road, and I met her agent, who became my agent, Chip McGregor, on Thunderdog. And we had a good time and collaborated well. And I think that there was a lot of value in that for me, because I know that I don't have the writing experience as such, but I know what's good when I read it. And I also know that I can add value. So we really had a very collaborative process of writing Thunderdog. A lot of it is hers and a lot of it is mine directly. And we blended the two, which was great. Now with the third book that we're getting, which is getting ready to do, which is going to talk about fear and controlling fear and people learning that they can overcome fear and not let it blind them, if you will, to being able to make decisions. The working title is A Guide Dog's Guide to Being Brave. And I'm doing that with a friend of Susie's, Carrie Wyatt Kent, because Susie is in a PhD program. Yeah, we love the title. We'll see what the publisher does. We've got a contract for it. We'll see what the publisher does with it over time. But so far, everybody likes it. That was a Carrie creation, because I was going to call it Blinded by Fear, which is more accurate in some senses. But I think A Guide Dog's Guide to Being Brave is a lot better title.
Yeah, it reminds me of that one. Is it The Art of Racing in the Rain?
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of something like that, where it's a little off of what the theme of the book is, but it's still engaging and it makes you want to know more about it.
It was a good book. And so
you said something that really resonated with me. You said, I know what's good when I read it. And I think that's a big obstacle for beginning writers, and is that usually if you're a writer, you're a reader first. And so I've read tons and tons of great books, and I know what great literature is, and I know what a great story is. And then when I write my first one, it's not very good. So you kind of have that huge gap between what you know is good and what you've produced. And so it's hard. You have to overcome that feeling of my stuff is really bad, you know, and you have to work really hard to make it as good as you want it to be, you know, as good as it is to be able to actually share with the world, you know, to get up to that level of what your bar is, the bar that you've set. And so I think that's something that stands, it's a barrier to a lot of people. And that's where I think a good editor comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look at John Grisham. You mentioned earlier, the first book he wrote, if I recall, was A Time to Kill, but it was the third one published. The first one that he wrote and it was published was The Firm. And then I'm trying to remember what the second one was.
Was it The Pelican Brief?
The Pelican Brief, right. And then A Time to Kill, which mm-hmm. was the Jake Brigance mm-hmm. initiator, if you will. But if you look at all of them, you can see how the books evolved over time and his writing style. So it is a natural progression. And I mentioned Rex Stout and Nero Wolfe. If you go back and read Fer de Lance, which was his first book, and you compare it with especially much later writings, you can see changes, but you can see where everything is starting from. And you get engaged. And in fact, Fer de Lance was not the first Nero Wolfe book I read. By a long shot, it wasn't the first. But having gone back and read it, even though everyone in the book, all the characters developed a fair amount since then and his writing style improved, it was engaging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about your mystery series.
Sure. It's about a college administrator named Cassandra Sato, and she lives in Hawaii. She gives up her life in Hawaii to move to Nebraska because she wants to accept her dream job at a tiny college called Morton College in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska. And she and her eventual goal is to become a college administrator or a college president. So she thinks this is, you know, the path that's going to get her there. But of course, moving from Hawaii to Nebraska is a very, very large culture shift. And so she encounters all kinds of problems, discrimination, barriers, everything. And a few months into her job, a student turns up dead on campus, and she has to be part of the group of people who figures out what happened to this student and then find justice.
Yeah, come on. Cassandra really did it. And she's just been hiding it through the whole series.
Yeah, that's the end of the series. It was Cassandra. All right.
That'll come later. That'll come in about the 100th book, right?
That's awesome.
When Karen awesome. And my wife and I are talking about who did it in various books, we usually do things like that. We've been reading a lot of the we've read J.A. Jantz too, but the J.D. Robb books, the In-Death series. Uh-huh. Have you read those? Uh-huh. And so
I have not read very many of those, no.
We oftentimes will spin a story how Eve Dallas really did it or Rourke did it and have just a lot of fun with it. But again, a great series of books. There's a lot of sex in those books, but they're still good J.D. Robb, mysteries.
Yeah.
But they're great mysteries.
Yeah. So, a lot of times people like the ones that I write, well, obviously I have 4 kids and grandkids, and my kids would cringe if they had to read a sex scene that I wrote. So, you know, my kids were like high school and college age when I started writing. So I decided all the sex in my books is going to be behind closed doors. And yeah, nobody wants to have their mom yet. No.
I've talked to several authors who say that, who one who said, I would never let my daughter or my wife read the books, or I changed the sex so that they could read them. Mm-hmm. But the value of having them read them is they're great critics. And so it's worthwhile. But yeah, it is fun to see how people react. But, you know, a mystery doesn't need to have all the violence thrown at you right out in the open, which is why puzzles are so great. James Patterson tends to be a little bit more violent, but not nearly as violent as he could be. So we've always enjoyed, of course, the Alex Cross series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's such a huge variety in, yeah, the violence level and all that stuff. I have a pretty vivid imagination. I don't really need people to spell some of that yep. stuff out for me. My mysteries are technically like cozy mysteries, which kind of means that there's no like blood on the page. There's no swearing. There's no sex. So like even, you know, high school kids can read them and that kind of thing. So I guess that's just... I just write what I like. So
come that's on, that's only because
that I like to read. So that's what I like to write.
Come on, that's only because Cassandra's trying to hide everything, but we know the truth.
That's right. She's really Voldemort.
Yeah, she's really Voldemort. Speaking of another good series of books.
Yeah, that's a whole different ballgame.
But you know, looking at the Harry Potter books again is another one where going from book 1 through book 7, just how it evolved. And they're so fun.
They are. They're definitely one of my, I like all genres. So yeah, I love Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Narnia. I mean, you name it. It's, I thought during the pandemic that I would just read all day, every day, but it turns out I actually have to do other stuff too. So
don't you hate it when that happens?
But there is no laundry fairy. I hate to be the person to tell you this, but there is no laundry fairy.
I haven't found one either. And I get to do the clothes washing at our house, which is fine. So for me, I love the brainless activities on Sunday. So there are 3 tasks that, well, 4 that I do on Sundays. It starts with doing the laundry or starting the laundry. Another is I take the cat box out. We use a litter called Litter One. It's not sand. It's all pine kernels, and you buy them and they come in a disposable box. So we just use a new box every week, but it's about the same as using regular sand that you buy in the store, But at the end of the week, you just throw the whole box out and put a new one up. And the cat is very demanding when it comes time to change the box. So that happens on Sunday. I take the trash out on Sunday. And then we have a little, we do get house cleaning help during the week. Karen's in a wheelchair. She's been in a chair her whole life. So it's kind of hard for us to do some of those things. So we do have a housekeeper that comes on Thursdays, in fact, and today's Thursday. So Jeanette is here, but we have a robot vacuum and I do the vacuuming again on Sunday with the robot in our bedroom, because that's also where Alamo, my guide dog, sleeps. So we get all those. So those are my four tasks on Sunday, and they're all pretty brainless in a sense. So I can read while they're going on, which is fun. And Karen is a quilter, so she's usually in sewing. And she's reading the same thing I read. So it's a question right now of who finishes which J.D. Robb book first.
Yeah, that is definitely the good thing about audiobooks is being able to multitask on some of those things that you don't have to pay so much attention to.
Tell me about your Duke the Deaf Dog ASL series.
Well, that is the second series that I started after I finished the mystery novels. I kind of had a moment where I realized that I started my own publishing company, and I just had a thought. I mean, it's kind of cliche. It was actually a dream that just came to me of like what I could do with this publishing company if I just kind of unleashed it. And so I came up with the idea of this orange English Spaniel dog who is deaf, and all of the people in his family can hear. And so it's just about different experiences that he has as the only person in a family of hearing people, and trying to get deaf and hard of hearing children to see themselves and their everyday life experiences on the pages of our books. But I also want kids who can hear to understand what it's like to hear differently. We just finished the third book, and I'm actually we just finished the fourth book. The third book just came out, but the fourth book is in production right now. And I had no idea when it started what it was going to end up being, but it's actually turned out to be more successful and I would say even more fun than my mysteries. The mysteries are kind of like my thing that I enjoy, as far as, like you said, creating the puzzle and the challenge of it. But the Duke the Deaf Dog ASL series is kind of what I feel like I'm taking my 30 whatever years of interpreting and hanging around with really cool deaf people and then like sharing that with the world.
So it's not a mystery series.
No, it is not. They are picture books. And they're only like less than 500 words, and each one is a different situation that Duke gets into. So there's like a different message in each one. More than 90% of children who are born deaf or hard of hearing have parents that can hear. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of research before I started the books, and there's very few books for young children that have deaf and hard of hearing characters. Once you get into like high school age or even beyond, there's more books that have deaf and hard of hearing characters. But at the kindergarten, first grade age, there's very few books. And you know, my kids had lots and lots of choices of books to read. So I feel like deaf kids should have lots and lots of choices of books that have characters like them in there. So each book has a different message. Like the first one was called Nevermind. And the message is that everyone deserves to be included in conversations. I mean, how many times do we tell people never mind when they ask us to repeat ourselves? Or maybe we have like a older parent or spouse who doesn't hear well, or even like someone who's just a little bit slower to act or to understand. A lot of times we just get impatient and say, forget it, I'll explain later. And This book, like after I published that first book, I've had so many deaf people come up to me and tell me stories of times when they've been told, never mind. And, you know, they thanked me for sharing their stories because they want hearing people to understand how hurtful those words are and what it feels to be left out. So I have a pretty long list of situations that I've seen throughout the years that I plan to incorporate into the books. And yeah, I'm only stopped by my amount of time and money to hire illustrators at this point.
Well, back to mysteries. Of course, there's the Cat Who series, Lillian Jackson Braun, and also Rita Mae Brown and Sneaky Pie Brown. But in thinking of the Cat Who books, why not have a Duke the Deaf Dog series solving mysteries and also deal with all the frustrations that Duke has of trying to get his humans to listen and how he has to figure things out, not being in a hearing world himself?
Mm-hmm. These Just a books thought. Are, yeah, that's a good thought. Actually, like I said, I have so many ideas. It's only really limited by my time and money. But the picture books are more like, so Duke's a dog.
Right.
It's more like he's like a people, like they stand on their hind legs and they kind of like, even his dad wears like a tie. So they kind of are like human, but they're dogs. But it's a nice way to be able to show diversity and like breeds of dogs and colors of dogs and abilities and body types and stuff without actually having like different children in there. So it's kind of like, I don't know if you remember the Mercer Mayer series, Little Critter. That's kind of what I thought of as
I know of like them, but I never model. Was able to read them.
Yeah, that was like my model, I guess, of who I thought of. It's like, so Duke is more just like a character, a fictional character. But I do have a couple of other ideas for series for like middle grade age kids. And those would be mysteries. And those would use some characters. I have a couple of young characters in the Cassandra Sato series. I did a Halloween short story last year called Scavenger Haunt. And that two of the main characters in there were 10-year-old kids. And so I think I want to do a separate series with them and have those be mysteries. Because I agree. I think I can incorporate a lot of the things that I know about the deaf community and deaf culture and ASL into a mystery and make it kind of fun that way.
And it's great that you're using this opportunity to teach people more about deaf and hard of hearing, not only as a culture, but as just as much an included and inclusive part of society as everyone else. I am concerned when you talk about Duke looking like a character and looking a little bit like people. I just don't want to see a new book coming out about Duke the Deaf Dog ASL series goes to Animal Farm. Just saying. But
hey, duly noted. Yeah.
So you did one of your books as a Kickstarter campaign?
We did. The most recent one that just published in January, I did my first Kickstarter campaign.
Now, why did you do that? What brought Kickstarter into it?
I went to this conference last fall in Las Vegas, and I met some authors who published their books first on Kickstarter before they released them more widely in other stores. And listening to them made me realize that Kickstarter might be a good way for me to reach new readers. The nice thing about Kickstarter, which I think you said that you've supported a couple of campaigns. Yes. Honestly, before I had gone to this conference, I did not think Kickstarter was something I needed to do. I hadn't really gone on there. I hadn't sponsored anybody else's project. So I just kind of went into it blindly. But I realized that the cool thing about Kickstarter is you get to develop a direct relationship with people who want to buy your product. So in my case, it's a book, but I've gone on there. And since then, I've supported all kinds of different projects. I've done a board game and a coloring book and a purse. And I mean, there's so many neat, creative ideas that people come up with and put them on Kickstarter just to see. So then the customers can come on and pledge money towards that product and say, yes, I think that's a great idea. The world needs that. And I'm willing to plunk down my money to pre-order that thing that you want to make. And so if enough of those people say that they'll pre-order the product, then the project is successful and it funds. And then the person who listed the project goes ahead and makes it. So that's been really exciting, but you have this direct relationship where the creator is sending you messages and keeping you updated on the progress, like, okay, you know, We're finished in publishing, you know, in the case of publishing, you say, okay, we finished the illustration. Now we're waiting for them to be printed. And then I actually personally boxed everything up and mailed them to the people with a personal note and some extra stickers and everything. So I think I really enjoy that contact with people and that communication, because it goes both ways. Then people can actually respond to me. If I just sell stuff on Amazon or in the local bookstore, I don't really know who buys my books. And so the Kickstarter has been a really cool way to just kind of, I guess, learn more about what people want and what people like about them. And it's kind of a neat way to have this direct relationship. It made me, I funded my first project successfully. We raised $2,500, which was enough money to buy some hardcover books. In the past, I hadn't been able to afford doing those books as a small publisher. So it's great to be able to order those books and get those into people's hands. They came with, they're very well done on nice thick paper with really vivid color illustrations, and then there's photos on each page of different ASL signs, and the photos are really clear. So it was definitely worth, I guess, the experience. So I'm actually going to be doing another one in July for the next Duke book. But as a person, like you said, you have a contract to do your next book, and so, you know, you get, a lot of times authors will get paid in advance. This is kind of almost the same thing, where I'm making this idea and then I'm like pre-paying some of the costs that it costs to produce the book, like, you know, the illustrating or the printing or all the different things that are associated with making the book. It's like a way for me to almost get like an advance, except it's directly coming from the customers instead of from the publishing company.
But I wonder if publishers have ever, that is traditional publishers, have ever used it as a way to explore what people think of a book that they're going to be putting out. Or another way to look at it is, as you've been, and as you went through the Kickstarter program for the first project, did you get input in any way from the people who were contributing or who were pre-ordering the book that helped you shape any of the part of the book that you wrote?
That's a good question. The book was pretty much finished before I started my project, because I wanted to shorten the length of time between when I closed the project and when I was able to deliver the books. But there are some people who are publishing books on Kickstarter who don't have them finished. I don't know if you're familiar with an author named Brandon Sanderson.
Yes.
Well, he did a Kickstarter in March where he offered 4 secret books that no one had ever gotten to read before except his wife. So he made it into, he calls it a year of Brandon Sanderson. And so every month in 2023, there's going to be a secret book box that comes out, and people pledged money to get a book a month or like a box a month for a year, with like either an ebook or a physical book or a hardcover book. I think there's t-shirts and pins and all kinds of swag, but he's such a successful author and he did this so well. His video on the platform was so engaging. He's such a great guy. He's such a great author. He has such a following that in less than a month, he raised $41 million.
Wow.
With 185,000 people backing his campaign. Now, to give you a comparison, I had 50 people backing my campaign. So, I mean, how cool is that? Like, he brought 185,000 customers to Kickstarter and to publishing. And so, you know, he's a person who is like a hybrid author. So he has some traditionally published books and some self-published books. But his little $40 million enterprise there, just, you know, he's basically starting a company just to do those book boxes next year. But the funny thing is, on his Kickstarter, there was no covers. Like, he didn't show anything. They were all secret. Like, authors like, or fans like him so much that they just bought everything sight unseen, because they were like, well, if Brandon Sanderson's writing it, I'm going to like it, so I'm going to pay for it.
Well, with 185,000 people, that's basically a little over $100, maybe about $130 or so, or $120 or so per person, which is pretty interesting. So there's a lot of investment, a lot of commitment for people to want to do that. So there's a goal for you in the future.
That's right. That's right. That's a good goal.
But I love the fact that you have really worked to engage people and that you have such a great mission of educating people about deaf and hard of hearing, and that you're trying to really help so many people, and that you're very committed to it. And that really is as good as it gets, and definitely appreciate that you're doing that.
Thank you. I think it's been really cool to, I love being an interpreter and I love writing, and it's been great to be able to put the two things that I love the most together and kind of come up with this cause, you know, that I just believe in with my whole heart. And I really think the world would be a better place if everybody just learned enough sign language to talk to their family and coworkers and classmates in school. And I don't want people to be left out.
And I think that's as laudable as it gets. And I want to thank you for being with us. We've been doing this for quite a while. The time passes and we're having a lot of fun with it, but I really appreciate you being here and helping us learn more about what it's like to be unstoppable, but learning about new cultures, getting so many new ideas. And I definitely hope that you're going to come back when you get another book published or whatever and tell us about it, and would love to hear about Kickstarter campaigns and so on. So you definitely need to keep us posted.
I definitely will. Thank you. I didn't realize we've been talking so long, but yeah, you're just really easy to talk to. So it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you. And again, for people listening, please reach out. Why don't you give us all the contact information, or how can people learn about you as well as learn more about your books and going to get them and so on?
Sure. My books are on sale pretty much anywhere. The eBooks of the Mysteries are exclusively on Amazon, but everything else is, you can get it directly from my website, which is kellybrockenhoff.com.
If you could spell that.
Pretty much. KellyBrakenhoff.com. And then I'm on a lot of social media, whatever. So hit me up, come to my website. It'll take you everywhere else that you need to go to find out about me.
Well, Kelly, thank you for being on Unstoppable Mindset. This has been absolutely fun and enjoyable, and I hope it is for everyone who listens. And you're right, we've gone on a long time, but it's worth it to hear the insights and all the things that you have brought us. So thank you for doing this. And for all of you listening, please reach out. Love to hear what you think about this. I'm sure Kelly would love to hear as well. So reach out to both of us. I gave you my email address at the beginning, but again, it's michaelhi@accessibe.com, or visit my podcast page, michaelhingson.com/podcast. And Michael Hingson is MichaelHingson. So michaelhingson.com/podcast, and give us a 5-star rating if you go there or wherever you're listening to the podcast. Love to get your input and love to hear what you think. And Kelly, for you and anyone listening, if you know of other people you think we ought to have on who have unstoppable stories to tell, we want to hear from you. So again, Kelly, for you, thanks very much for being here. And we're looking forward to the next time we get to chat.
I look forward to that too. Have a great day. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much.
To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.